Over the series of meetings this year, we've touched on three of the important conceptual structures of the Buddhist teachings. The first one that we started talking about is the four foundations of mindfulness. And the four noble truths. The first of the noble truths is that we struggle with stress. Life is stressful. It's called dukkha. And the second noble truth is that dukkha is caused by craving and clinging. And craving is, you know, it's hardwired into any creature. It's an instinctual response to pleasure and pain. But it's an added dimension with humans. It's the pleasure and pain, not just of being in a body, but the stories that we create, the moods that we inhabit. And clinging is our identification with those experiences as this is who I am, this is how the world is. The third noble truth is that it's possible to be free of craving and clinging, either on a kind of a temporary, circumstantial basis. That's one of the benefits of regular meditation practice. Or, ultimately, nirvana, the experience of the unconditioned. And then the fourth noble truth is the Noble Eightfold Path. And we spent a lot of time on that. It basically has three elements. The wisdom element, the virtue element, and the discipline element. The virtue element basically is organized around a lifestyle that maximizes our ability to liberate ourselves from dukkha as much as possible. We're not renunciates. We live in the world, and we have to contend with that. So virtue creates a foundation for investigation and discipline. And that's where mindfulness meditation comes into play. And then the result of that is wisdom. And so we spent several talks reviewing those conceptual topics, and we dove deeply into the four foundations of mindfulness, which in the mental discipline part of the Eightfold Path is right mindfulness. So we explored that and talk about the four foundations of mindfulness. Mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of the mind, and mindfulness of mental phenomena. Okay, so we can consider that those developments, those conceptual structures, this for example, we might consider that the Four Noble Truths kind of, it's like a sheet of music. It provides some kind of cognitive structure to read music, to be able to, you know, make beautiful sounds. Then we might consider a piano as being the tool that we use to make the sound. And then there's the training, the practice of hitting the keys, the right sequence with the right kind of feeling, not just sensory feeling, but emotional feeling. That's how we make beautiful music. So the Four Noble Truths represents sort of like the sheet music. And the Four Foundations of Mindfulness represents the instrument that we work with, describes, you know, the different aspects of inhabiting a body, the sensations, feelings, state of mind, and what I call the selfing story that we all are so attached to. And so the practice of training involves what's called the Anapanasati practice. And that's really what I want to talk about in more depth tonight. And that's sort of like the training. It's like playing the piano. It provides instructions. And that's what I'll be reviewing tonight. Now, what I want to ask you all to do is take a look at the notes that I'm going to post and practice. And next Wednesday night, the Dharma Talk will be a guided meditation along the lines of what are called the 16 or the four tetrads, the 16 practice points of the Anapanasati Sutta. And then we'll talk about your meditation experience. So it's sort of like how to apply it, right? So, first let me describe Anapanasati. The word, it's a composite word, mindfulness of breathing. Ana means inhalation, breathing in. Apana means exhalation or breathing out. And sati is mindfulness. It's a kind of awareness, a remembering to stay present. I've said this many times before, and I think it's relevant to repeat it, that the original application of the word sati had to do with how well the Brahmin priests remembered the rites and rituals, the ceremonies, or the teachings of Brahmanism, and how well they actually performed them. And the assumption was when they were performed perfectly, the gods had to respond favorably. If they didn't perform them perfectly, things didn't turn out as planned. Right? The Buddha repurposed that. Instead of remembering these rites and rituals, these ceremonies, remember how craving and clinging operates. Remember that there is liberation from craving and clinging. And here's how to go about doing it. Don't forget that. So I want to make that clear that that's what mindfulness of breathing is about. It's about using attention in skillful ways. And that's what the Anapanasati Sutta describes. Now, there are different versions of the Sutta, by the way. One of them is really long, and basically it turns into a kind of a travelogue. The first part describes how many monks are there and which ones are in which levels of training, and they're all doing such a great job. Therefore, you deserve to hear, and then we hear the Anapanasati Sutta. So I'm going to post a translation of that from one of my favorite books on mindfulness of breathing called Mindfulness of Breathing by Bhikkhu Anālayo. I'm using his translation, and that's what's in these notes. I actually took a course through the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies last year that focused on that book and this practice. So another thing I want to say about this practice in terms of mindfulness of breathing, its value from a kind of contemporary psychological perspective, it trains the way the brain is organized. There are various connections, millions and millions of connections, neural connections in the brain. And extends down into the body with the, you know, the nervous system that goes out into the body. Very, very complex series of interactions. And there's strong evidence that mindfulness meditation practice actually amplifies the skill of paying attention and the skill of effective self-regulation and the skill of internal introspective investigation. There's a really be disciplined in that. Process. And so that's what we're cultivating with this. And it's a form of conditioning. That's really what the second and third Noble Truths talk about. The second Noble Truth said, we're conditioned by craving and clinging. And third Noble Truth basically says, Well, we can decondition. We can change our minds. The ultimate deconditioning is the experience of nirvana. But this is not really about that. This is about waking up from the daydream that we walk through, being more truly present for life experience in ways that are kind and compassionate for self and for the rest of the world. So, this conditioning, in psychological terms, there's two ways to understand it, two different forms of it. One of them is classical conditioning or Pavlovian conditioning. Basically, the way it was developed was this scientist named Pavlov had some dogs, and he set it up so that when the dogs were hungry, he had this rig around their mouths that would collect saliva. And then he would ring a bell and present the food. And the dogs, when they ate the food, they would take the mask off and the dog would eat the food. Well, it turns out that the conditioning, the classical conditioning, they could ring the bell without feeding the dog food and it would still salivate. Right? So there's an external prompt and an internal response that becomes routinized or habituated. Classical conditioning. That's craving and clinging. Then there's also what's called operant conditioning. And operant conditioning basically involves a person makes a choice and there are consequences to that choice. If you make a beneficial choice, you receive a reward. So that behavior is more likely to be repeated over time. Then there's also the different kind of conditioning. When you do a certain routine, there's a negative consequence, an unpleasantness. So you might tend to avoid that. Unfortunately, a glitch in the system is that we're habitually used to the second one. We're strongly conditioned by fear of negative outcome, because we've experienced negative outcomes in the past, right? And we might develop a whole series of maladaptive coping strategies for that. But this sees through that. Now, I want to give an example using a dog of this operant conditioning using my own dog, Mary. We have a little bell hanging by the door going out the back of the house into the backyard. It's a fenced-in yard. She has plenty of room to run. If she wants to go outside, she nudges the bell. We hear it, we open the door. She gets to go outside. That's the reward. That's operant conditioning, right? Now, we're classically conditioned to pay attention when the bell rings, right? So, now, and of course, the operant conditioning for us is that when we actually comply, our dog's happy. And she doesn't make a mess in the house. Right? So the other side of that is if she's out there barking, that triggers in us a disciplinary mode. We call her back in. So there's a negative consequence for her barking. She does it on a regular basis. However, that turns into a different kind of operant conditioning because she's learned now if she comes to the back door and quietly barks, when she wants to come in, we'll open the door for her. And the reward for her is that she gets to come back in, right? So those are behavioral examples of that phenomenon. Now, the other thing that's important to understand about operant conditioning is that there tend to be an association of different behaviors and mindsets. And the example that came to mind when I was preparing these notes, when I was a young man, I went to a folk concert. It was big back in the late 60s and early 70s. And there was a fellow there, I wish I could remember his name. He was pretty famous. He was playing the fiddle and singing and clogging simultaneously. Clogging is almost like tap dancing, a certain kind of way you stomp your feet. It was remarkable, and he was really, really good at it. So that's operant conditioning. I imagine he enjoyed it. When someone performs at that high level, it's joyful. I mean, that leads to the whole notion about performing meditation at a high level. It's joyful, right? So that's an important thing to understand about operant conditioning in terms of the development of awakening that can be cultivated with the Anapanasati practice. The Four Foundations concept and the Four Foundations concept are very useful because they describe the structure and the procedures. Say again, the Anapanasati structure is about how to train the mind. It's how to realize the potential of the Third Noble Truth and how to realize the potential of the Fourth Noble Truth, Noble Eightfold Path, and how to put all the pieces together, particularly the fourth foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of the mind, mindfulness of mental phenomena, in a way that produces waking up from being lost in story. So, when we're talking about how we normally live our lives in this classical conditioning, in psychology, we call that an external locus of control. In that way, my well-being, my success, my failure, etc., etc., is in reaction to something that happens in the outside world, right? If I do such and such a job with operant conditioning, I will be rewarded, right? But also that as the mind is conditioned into reactivity to desire or aversion, that becomes deeply embedded, and it's what we call an external locus of control. And anyone who's in control of the external environment controls how you feel, right? This happens in abusive relationships. It happens in abusive business situations, so forth and so on, right? So from a psychotherapy perspective, there's a strong vulnerability or weakness when you operate your value, self-value, your sense of value of the world depends on external factors. I'll call it living from the outside in. Buddhism, mindfulness of breathing, emphasizes what's called an internal locus of control. We're still operating in the world. There's still triggers, and you know, we're still cued to respond in certain ways to those triggers, which is where the external locus of control situation is. But our ability to manage and resolve it emerges from our own internal training. It's not so driven. I could say that, you know, I need food to survive. So that, in a sense, is an external locus of control. But how much food, how often I eat it, what kind of food, I can determine that, right? That's where the internal locus of control interacts with the world. And it produces a sense of satisfaction and happiness, joy. I kind of alluded to that earlier. So here's my review of the Anapanasati Sutta. Like I said, I'm going to post Analyo's translation, but I'm going to read excerpts from it today and describe it. And the four tetrads are ways to understand and train to bring to fulfillment the four foundations of mindfulness. The first tetrad, mindfulness of the body. Second tetrad, mindfulness of feelings. Third tetrad, mindfulness of the mind. Fourth tetrad, mindfulness of mental phenomena. But in each one of those, each tetrad is about training. Here's how you train the mind. for this, to understand this first foundation. Here's how you train the mind to understand the second foundation, et cetera, et cetera. So it's an instruction manual. Okay. Here's the first part of the first tetrad. Breathing in long, one understands, I breathe in long. Breathing out long, one understands, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, one understands, I breathe in short. Breathing out short, one understands, I breathe out short. One trains, experiencing the whole body, I shall breathe in. One trains, experiencing the whole body, I shall breathe out. One trains, calming bodily activity, I shall breathe in. One trains, calming bodily activity, I will breathe out, I shall breathe out. So, this terminology, when breathing in long, I understand I'm breathing in long. That understanding is not conceptual. It basically means you have direct experiential awareness of what occurs in awareness during that interval when air is coming into the body. And the same thing with air is going out of the body. Now, one of the things that's important to understand about the experience of mindfulness of breathing, it requires mindful intention to enact. Our nervous systems are hardwired to react to novelty and to be pulled towards something that's pleasant or pulled to avoid something that's unpleasant. Hardwired for that. It's built into the nervous system. The sensation of breathing is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So we have to consciously decide to focus attention on it, consciously decide to sustain that attention for the duration of the in-breath. Okay. That deciding to go to the breath is called vitakka in Pali, which is kind of the classical language of this form of Buddhism. And then sustaining that attention is called vichara. You do the same thing for the out-breath. And what happens, whenever the mind is excited, either pleasantly or unpleasantly, adrenaline goes through the body. The adrenaline is either feeding desire or feeding aversion. But when you pay attention to the breath, because it is neither, it's neutral, it does not tell the body to generate adrenaline. So the body starts to systematically relax. The muscles become slack, but at the same time, we remain mentally alert. That's one of the things I most enjoy about my sitting practice, particularly on retreats, is how stable and still my mind is in a relaxed body. It's very joyful, right? Which is one of the tetrads. I think it's the next one. So experiencing the whole body, I shall breathe out. One trains, calming bodily activity, I shall breathe in. One trains, calming bodily activity, I shall breathe out. I just breathe out. That's what I just described. The other thing to understand about it is that that's part of the operant conditioning. There's a decision that's prompted internally to pay attention to the breath. It's not like there's a sound I need to check out or even something like a pain in my knee that I need to check out. There's something going on in the function of the mind, right? That's the basis for operant conditioning. It's karmic decision-making, being aware of positive or negative outcomes depending on your behavior, which is what karma is about. So, the other thing that's important to understand about this, when I'm practicing it, there's been a controversy over the centuries about what does it mean, the body, the whole body. One school says that it means that you're aware of the whole body, all of the in-breath without distraction, all of the out-breath without distraction. Another understanding is that the whole body is breathing. Pay attention to that. When I first learned how to practice mindfulness meditation, I was trained to notice the expanding and contracting of the abdomen. Right? I did that for years. Then I shifted to the area up around my nose. And so that is embodied practice, but it becomes more specific in terms of the abdomen or the area around the nose and the upper lip. Then I learned what's called body scanning practice through the teachings of Asen Goenka. So I learned how to bring attention to the entirety of my embodied experience. And when you do that in a very systematic way, you train the mindfulness of breathing to be very, very alert and relaxed and calm. And then you start to dive into what's going on sensationally in the body at deeper and deeper levels. And you can get to this level of awareness where the whole body kind of dissolves into a vibratory field. There's nothing magical or mystical or metaphorical about that. It's literally, you know, what happens when your arm goes to sleep, that tingling sensation, that's going on everywhere in the body all the time. This training is to become more and more aware of that. What that does is it creates a profound quality of physical relaxation, mental alertness, and emotional calm. Right? So that's what I do. When I'm doing this practice, when I mentioned the vagal nerve connects from the base of the brain, goes down through the torso. Nerve endings go to the throat. You ever get that tight feeling in your throat? Right? Maybe you can't speak. Or in your lungs. Or your heart. Particularly your heartbeat. Blood pressure, stuff like that. And ends up connected to the wall, the lining of your intestines. And then another branch of that vagus nerve send signals from those areas of the body back up to the brain. So there's this signal going on all the time, even as I'm speaking right now. It connects the brain with the body, connects the mind with the body, and with feelings. And so this practice, the reason when I teach people to do this, I teach people to breathe into their body. Notice the breath. This is what the training got from Goenka. Try to go into what feels like to be in your body, the vibratory field, and then be curious about what's going to happen. That's the first tetrad. Second tetrad. One trains experiencing joy. I shall breathe in. One trains experiencing joy. I shall breathe out. One trains experiencing happiness. I shall breathe in. One trains experiencing happiness. I shall breathe out. One trains experiencing mental activity. I shall breathe in. One experiencing mental activity. I shall breathe out. One trains calming mental activity. I shall breathe in. One trains calming mental activity. I shall breathe out. So I mentioned before that when you're paying attention to the sensation of breathing and when you're paying attention to that vibratory field, the amount of adrenaline in your bloodstream dissipates. It's like the fuel gets burned up. And so there's a quietness in the body, a relaxation in the body, and the mind is alert. Calming mental activity is what I was talking about. That's how we calm mental activity. And one of the results of when the mind is, you know, still not trained and there's adrenaline flowing through the system, there's this level of anxiety or pressure that we're all living through, right? And that's a driver of the stories we tell ourselves and how we operate in the world. So when we can bring that system to this point of stability, it's called samadhi paucity. Samadhi is Stability of attention and paucity is tranquility, emotional tranquility. And we can produce that with this. Joy occurs. And joy basically means that the energy that would otherwise be tied up in stressing out is freed up. And it creates a quality of buoyancy that can be quite ecstatic when the mind gets really, really concentrated. But the way I experience it, it's more a quality of emotional buoyancy, lightheartedness, enjoyment, enthusiastic interest. Even if what's going on in my body is unpleasant, the mind can be very curious about what it feels like to be in that experience. And that quality of attention is being cultivated. And there's this sense of okayness. That's what the happiness is about. Contentment about the experience. And like I'm saying, the mind can be contented even if the body is uncomfortable. I've had to deal with, you know, different kinds of painful issues because I've been doing this for half my life. But when my mind is well trained, I know the body is in pain, but the mind is okay, enjoying the ride, so to speak. That doesn't mean that I stop taking care of myself. It just means that when I'm in that kind of situation and I know there's not a whole lot I can do with it, about it, or if I want to do something about it, I'd have to stop meditating and that would just not be worth it. I'll just keep sitting, right? So this is calming mental activity. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't any thoughts. And some of you heard me say this over and over again because it really is important. It starts out, there's like this little demon telling you a story, it perched on your shoulder. You can't ignore it and you have to do what it says. But with this calming, the demon's in the other room with the door closed. And the demon's either going to tell you the most wonderful things that you really should think more about or the most awful things that you should really be scared about, right? But if it's in the other room with the door closed, you know it's there, but it's not that important. It cultivates something that's called, in Buddhism, it's called viraga, dispassion. It doesn't mean being emotionally flat. It basically means that you're emotionally present but not driven, not reactive. It's a quality of balance or equanimity. So that's the calming mental activity, is that it's not that thoughts don't occur, that they're very peripheral, right? It's like a neighbor in the other room or the other building. If you wanted to pay attention, you could, but it's so much more pleasant to pay attention here, right? Okay. The third tetrad, one trains experiencing the mind I shall breathe in, one trains experiencing the mind I shall breathe out, one trains gladdening the mind I shall breathe in, one trains gladdening the mind I shall breathe out, one trains concentrating the mind I shall breathe in, one trains concentrating the mind I shall breathe out, one trains liberating the mind I shall breathe in, one trains liberating the mind I shall breathe out. So as this voice, the selfing story, becomes quieter and less demanding, less controlling, the spaciousness that occurs, the openness of mind. When I say spaciousness, I don't mean spaced out. I mean the consciousness seems to be open, not struggling to want or not want. It kind of expands out, so to speak. Not literally, but it just has that quality of not being struggling, not struggling about anything other than just staying present. And that's not even a struggle. And that's what gladdening the mind is. Concentrating the mind basically means that whatever conditioning factors in the mind that create distress and confusion are pretty much inoperative or very faint, viraga, right? So all the different healthy functions of the mind start to become more interactive and more coherent and more effective and more beneficial. And those factors are called the seven awakening factors, which I've talked about many times. And you go to the website and look in the archives, you'll see somewhere you'll see the word awakening factors, words. When I get to that stage of practice, the mind, and I don't have to get into that vibratory field for this to happen. It can just be that there's a quietness, but there's still this openness down into the body. And it particularly is benefited as the breath becomes quieter, the mind is less jammed up with adrenaline energy, and yet there's still this quality of curious, attentive interest in what's going on. That whole process, the out-breath becomes prolonged and more subtle and faint. And there might be long periods of time, and I kind of breathe out into my body. And there might be whole long periods of time that, I don't know, a minute or more, I'm not keeping time. But it's an extended period of time when there's no breathing, there's just stillness, openness, clarity, peacefulness. And I just hang out there, right? That's liberating the mind. In this context, it's liberating the mind from the grosser aspects of craving and clinging. There's still a self-identity. There's still a sense of an observer and an observed. In this case, the observer is very alert, peaceful, non-reactive, and the observed is this openness, right? That's liberating. If that's all I ever achieve in my life, I am so grateful. Is to have that quality of present moment, appreciative, non-reactivity. Fourth tetrad. One trains contemplating impermanence, I shall breathe in. One trains contemplating impermanence, I shall breathe out. One trains contemplating dispassion, I shall breathe in. One trains contemplating dispassion, I shall breathe out. One trains contemplating cessation, I shall breathe in. One trains contemplating cessation, I shall breathe out. One trains contemplating letting go, I shall breathe in. One trains contemplating letting go, I shall breathe out. I already mentioned letting go in terms of the out-breath. I just keep letting go and not really struggling about when the in-breath is going to begin. That letting go, and this is that, I talked about the associative conditioning, operant conditioning. The sensation of breathing becomes co-aligned with, integrated with this letting go process. The letting go process starts with noticing when the mind's distracted, redirecting attention back to the breath. That's letting go of the distraction, the hindrance. But this letting go is deeper and more subtle and more profound. It's just an opening that doesn't have any particular goal in mind other than opening, letting go with curiosity. And then something will happen. There'll be an in-breath. When this used to happen, I would think that I'd done something wrong and I'd be worried and anxious. But I read about it, and with enough retreat experience, I realized, oh yeah, I know what they're talking about. This is very peaceful. I can go for long periods of time. The breathing is very, very faint and subtle. And when I say faint, it's not like it's in the other room. It just does not require a lot of in-breath or out-breath. It's a remarkable experience. It's very peaceful. It's not something you decide to do. It's something that comes about as a result of being skillful at what I just suggested, right? And so that letting go becomes effortless and peaceful and open. Cessation basically is the highest potential of awakening. Cessation basically means the sense of there being an observer in that which is observed, or an experiencer in that which is experienced, just goes away. That's the dispassion. I mentioned viraga. In your contemplating dispassion, I shall breathe in. One trains contemplating dispassion, I shall breathe out. That's viraga. And it's this quality of being really alert and open and ready to deal with whatever comes up, right, in the sitting practice. This is not something that you would try to do, you know, driving down the road or hanging out with a friend. This is a deep training that we do with the meditation practice, the Anapanasati. But the association is when you use the breath while you're meditating, and you start to associate it while you're meditating with being more introspectively aware and less reactive, more open, those all become associated with one another. The common cue is mindfulness of breathing, but mindfulness of the body and mindfulness of feelings and mindfulness of the mind and mindfulness of mental phenomena become associated with, integrated with that. That's the kind of operant conditioning learning that I was wanting to describe at the beginning of the discussion. So at the end of the sutta, I mentioned earlier the seven awakening factors. The end of the sutta, at the end of the Satipatthana Sutta and at the end of the Anapanasati Sutta, talks about the seven awakening factors. Seven awakening factors are those qualities of conditions in the mind, those channels that the energy of being present, of life involve, are really, they're wholesome, they liberate the mind from distress and confusion, and they're very well integrated and coherent and powerful. Those are, that's the goal of the practice. It's been what I've been interested in for the last 10 or 15 years, is really understanding how to recognize this awakening factor subjectively in my own experience, and how to create conditions that make them more and more coherent and enjoyable and beneficial. Now, if you want to look up the seven awakening factors, just look them up. They're posted on the website archives as well. But here's what has to say about the awakening factors. One dwells contemplating, diligent, clearly comprehending and mindful, free from desire and discontent with regard to the world. At that time, mindfulness is established continuously. At a time when mindfulness is established in one continuously, at that time the awakening factor of mindfulness is aroused in one. At that time, the awakening factor of mindfulness comes to be accomplished in one by cultivation. It has the same kind of wordage for second awakening factor, which is investigation of mental phenomena. The third one is energy. And energy basically means you know that the energy of your attention is flowing into the right channels and you can do it persistently. It's basically persistent right effort. One of the training aspects of the Eightfold Path. So, effort, joy, the awakening factor of joy, the awakening factor of concentration, and tranquility, awakening factor of tranquility, and the awakening factor of equipoise. Now, the one when it talks about the one equipoise, the wording is different in important ways. One carefully oversees, without interfering, the mind that has become concentrated in this way. At a time when one carefully oversees, without interfering, the mind that has become concentrated in this way. At that time, the awakening factor of equipoise is aroused in one. At that time, one cultivates the awakening factor of equipoise. At that time, the awakening factor of equipoise comes to be accomplished in one by cultivation. So, in that context of the seven awakening factors, I've talked about this before as well. You can find it in the review. The first three are the most important: mindfulness, investigation of mental phenomena, and right effort. Mindfulness, sati, remember to keep paying attention, to remember to keep using the breath as your stabilizing point of reference as you go through this process. Investigation. I talked about vitaka and vichara, aiming attention at the beginning of the in-breath, sustaining it for the duration of the in-breath, repeating that for the out-breath. That's the first tetrad. That's the training wheels for investigation of mental phenomena. That you develop that protocol of deliberately kind of soaking your attention into the in-breath, the way that water soaks into a sponge. And that you have this quality of ongoing, persistent application of mindfulness and investigation. And that's the energy awakening factor. Those three are the drivers of the other awakening factors. Because they're that way, joy becomes apparent and tranquility becomes apparent. You remember what I was reading in those earlier tetrads. Joy and tranquility are part of what goes on in each developmental aspects of each one of those. So the mind becomes increasingly stable and unified in its functioning. That's the concentration factor. And it's peaceful. I mentioned that also. There's a certain level where you just keep letting go and opening. But the mind is so well trained. It's like being a concert level professional pianist, that you get there and you get in the groove, right? You know the groove. Everybody in the auditorium knows the groove. Anybody who hears what you're playing knows the groove. That's what we're talking about here. That quality of concentration, and it's all balanced. Not too much energy, not too much tranquility, not too much flakiness, inattentiveness, but not too much preoccupation and stickiness in what you're paying attention to. That balance is equipoise. And it all grows from the practice of mindfulness of breathing. Now, I mentioned earlier in the discussion that next week, I'm inviting you all to look at the notes and try to apply that to your meditation practice during the interval between now and next week. And then in our next Wednesday night, I will provide a guided meditation that reflects the... Actually, there are other guided meditations in the archives that reflect on this kind of practice of mindfulness of breathing associated with the Dharma talk that I gave last year sometime, I think. You can use that to practice with. But after the guided meditation next week, I want to coach you. I want to hear about your meditation practice, either that night or what you experienced in the interval. Let's talk about it so I can provide you some pointers that will help you to be get more benefit out of this practice. So we have some time left. The opportunity presents itself for you all to ask any questions you might want to have about what you heard me say. This noble silence, or just, my God, thank God he shut up.
I don't have any questions, but I was following along, and so what I do often is I have very, very high interoception, which means my awareness of what's going on inside of my body, and I believe it comes from all the body sweeps that I've done over the years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I actually got my first inhaler this year, and I was diagnosed with asthma as a kid. I have always meditated through asthma attacks, where I focus on what's going on, I understand what's going on, and I create the space for my body to do what it needs to do, get through that attack. I don't put a label on it. I don't have any fear, because the breath is my vehicle taking me through.
That's it. You got it.
Every time, I can calm myself down. I can open up my lungs. I can allow, you know, whatever's going on physiologically to settle and get through. And I even did this recently when I went into medical shock, because my body thought I was being gutted because I'm doing this massive detox, cellular detox. It caused me to have a massive bowel movement, and just the change of pressure in my body made my vagus nerve think that I was gutted, went into medical shock. Most people would have called 911, gone to the emergency room, but I know what was going on, and I was literally able to feel the mast cells opening, the histamine coming out, my body responding to the histamine. It was at each individual step that I felt at a cellular level, based on being able to just get the story out, just let go of the story, experience what's going on, understanding what's going on, and not getting scared by it, because I knew what was happening.
Right.
And letting the body, through the breath and the control of the breath, calm and moved on. But it could have been terrifying. Most people, I think, would have been terrified being in medical shock.
Well, it depends. If they had cultivated sufficient equanimity, like I was mentioning, I mean, I've gone through kidney stone episodes mindfully.
There you go. Yeah.
So, yeah, I understand how that operates. Other observations or questions about the potential or the concept that is involved with this mindfulness of breathing protocol?
I found it interesting, your analogies between operant conditioning and classical conditioning, because I feel like once you've trained yourself in the breath and in meditation, that it actually should become a classical conditioning situation where it signals to your body what's happening.
Yeah, operant conditioning is actually a different perspective on classical conditioning.
Right. Yeah, so that's what I mean. So it should morph into the classical conditioning if you have, you know, worked through it and done, I don't want to say done it correctly because that's not the right wording, but if your body, you should get to a point where your body does that and it becomes kind of a classical condition. You've trained your body to do this because you're doing something else first, and that leads your body to something else.
Yep. Very important part of this practice is learning how to work with the energy in the body. Other questions or comments? John?
When did you first experience the mental side with this new awareness? I mean, how long did you sit before it became apparent?
I'm not quite sure I understand what you mean by the mental side.
Every time you sit, you have a brain. Every time you sit, you have more experience sitting, but it's how you use it. So you're more alert to what your mind is doing to your body, and you're not shocked at all.
Well, when you're saying that, John, what I'm thinking of is the third foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of the mind. And basically what that means is, what's the quality of your attention or your awareness? Is the mind alert or dull? Is the mind agitated or tranquil? Is the mind scattered and undisciplined or, you know, workable and focused? Is the mind rigid or is the mind flexible? To be able to, you know, understand how the process comes together.
The different parts.
Right, and that can be analogous to musicianship. You know, a person who's an excellent musician they have the craft of being able to pluck the strings or hit the keys or blow in the on the horn in the right way, in the right sequence, to make a sound and have it make sense. People can identify, oh, I know that song, right? But that's not necessarily music. That's not beauty. It's just physical competency. But the whole notion of virtue in terms of the Eightfold Path, right speech, right action, right livelihood, that's what makes it beautiful.
That's all I'm asking is, when did you distinguish within yourself this compatibility, this feeling? How long?
I don't know. I've been doing this for over half my life. I couldn't say. I mean, obviously I was getting glimpses of it early on, but it becomes more and more clear to me. That's one of the things that I think is valuable about this practice. The more I study, the more I do it, the more I talk about it. I mean, it's really an advantage for me to be a teacher and have the capability that I have to kind of pull it all together, is that it deepens my understanding of how this operates. So I can say that over time, I understand that quality of mind better than ever before. But I couldn't tell you when it started. It's just becoming more and more clear because of the intersection between studying, talking about it, and actually sitting with it. It's like the difference between learning how to play tennis by reading a book and then actually getting out there with the tennis racket and the ball and learning how to stand and how to, you know, hit the ball and all that stuff.
I think there is this talking part, too, that becomes clearer for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Satish.
Well, as I mentioned before, when I'm meditating, following my breath in and out, I am out of focus on my breath most of the time, you know.
You are focused? Or you're not focused?
I'm not focused. Because I have thoughts happening, you know. And I just bring it back to my breath.
As long as you come back to the breath more often than you stay with the distraction, you're in the right track. And the more you practice, the more you're diligent about it. There's a term, it's called Adapi Sati Sampajanya. Adapi means being diligent.
Yeah.
You know, not putting it on cruise control, as I say. Sati is mindfulness, remembering what you're there to do. And Sampajanya is clearly knowing. Direct experiential knowledge, not conceptual overlays.
I'm so far away from samadhi.
Well, more practice is necessary.
Yeah.
That's the training. And that's one of the values of this kind of exchange, is that you have a clearer idea of what potential there is for you to go further. And now, instead of being caught in, I can't do this, it's better to say, how can I be better at this? Something to look forward to rather than something to fight against.
Yes, practice. You know, diligent practice. Like
it. Yep. Yep. So I think we're at the end of our discussion for this evening. It's our custom at the end of our meetings for us to sit together momentarily in silence. So let's do that. Thank you for your practice. Wish you well. And I hope that we're all safe and happy until the next time we have a chance to chat.